Voices of protest on tonight's news front. Mississippi NAACP leader Charles Evers and the NAACP 1968 program. And famed pediatrician Benjamin Spock now under federal indictment for persuading others to oppose the draft. Good evening. Monday, January 8th, 1968, and this is Newsfront on the Eastern Educational Network. I'm Mitchell Krause, and tonight, exclusive interviews with Charles Evers of the NAACP and Dr. Benjamin Spock, the subject protest for equal rights and against the draft, and news analyst Quincy Howe on Europe's protest against the proposed American monetary policies. But first, for the latest news, here's reporter Milt Haynes.
Good evening. With the budget already behind schedule and expected to run well over $100 billion, President Johnson tonight announced the resignation of Budget Director Charles L. Schulz. Schulz has been chief of staff in developing the government's financial programs. The president named Charles J. Zwick to replace Schulz. Adam Clayton Powell came back to the United States tonight. Powell, stopping in Miami on his way to a speaking tour in California, said, "I'll be walking the streets of Watts tonight." The congressman-elect from New York's 18th District said he would return directly to the island of Bimini after his California speaking tour. Asked when he would return to New York, Powell snapped, "When my lawyers say so." Roy Wilkins of the NAACP said in New York tonight that his organization is going to continue to work for integration and equality, concentrating on employment for Negroes in the coming year. Wilkins hit out at black separatists and refuted the contention of what he called self-anointed experts that the civil rights movement is dead. All militants, said Wilkins, are not crazy, and all moderates are not Uncle Toms. President Johnson's emissary to Cambodia, Ambassador Chester Bowles, arrived in Phnom Penh at Prince Sihanouk's invitation. Sihanouk, with great pressure building upon him, said Bowles is wasting his time, that he might as well go see the ruins at Angkor Wat, because there's no possibility that Cambodia will allow U.S. forces to pursue communist troops into his country. Prince Sihanouk said in a Sunday press conference that he would never lick the boots of that Johnson. If he, Johnson, wants to talk, he'll come to my house. In Warsaw, the envoys of the United States and Communist China had their 134th direct contact in the Polish capital. This meeting between U.S. Ambassador to Poland John Grunowski and the Chinese Chargé d'Affaires Shen Teng. The talks in Warsaw are the only official contact between the two governments, and today's discussion of positions and intentions was the first in 7 months. Israel's Prime Minister Levi Eshkol finished his talks with President Johnson at the LBJ Ranch today and said the president had agreed to active, sympathetic review of Israel's military defense capability. That capability looked pretty good as Israeli jets flew over to knock out Jordanian artillery positions that had engaged Israeli guns and tanks in an hour's duel across the Jordan River. In Palo Alto, California, the first adult heart transplant patient in this country is in critical condition. Mike Kasparak, the 54-year-old steel worker who was given the heart of a 43-year-old woman who died Saturday night, was experiencing internal bleeding, which has now been stopped. New York Senator Robert Kennedy said he would not take a position during the spring primaries. That was taken to mean he will not step in to help Senator Eugene McCarthy in McCarthy's bid to mount a protest movement against President Johnson's war policies. Mr. Kennedy said, "My judgment is, at the moment, that I don't further the cause of peace by supporting McCarthy in the primaries." Senator Kennedy says he feels frustration that he cannot get the Johnson administration to test North Vietnam's latest peace offers. The polls released by the Lewis Harris and Dr. George Gallup organizations today found President Johnson right back up at the top of the heap, defeating every Republican or independent candidate in sight. 4 months ago, those polls indicated that any major Republican, Nixon, Romney, Rockefeller, or Reagan, would have defeated Mr. Johnson. Today, the reverse is true, with only Governor Rockefeller of New York running even close to the president. Mr. Rockefeller ties the president 43% to 43%, but when the George Wallace factor is added, Johnson is the victor. That election is 7 months away. A move began today by Oregon Republicans to put the name of Governor Nelson Rockefeller on the ballot for the May 28th primary in that state. If Rockefeller files an affidavit to keep his name off the ballot, his supporters say they'll lead a write-in campaign for him there. Rockefeller won the 1964 Oregon primary. His antagonist in that campaign, Barry Goldwater, is beneficiary of a national fundraising campaign to finance an effort to put Goldwater back in the Senate. He would be running against Senator Carl Hayden, 90 years old, who has been in the Senate since 1927. Asked if he'll run again, Hayden said, why not? Michigan's Governor George Romney, a GOP candidate, said he feels the United States should not stop bombing North Vietnam without evidence the action would lead to a satisfactory settlement of the war. Romney said he would take that position in the New Hampshire primary. He admitted that he's an underdog in that race. Rounding out the political news, Richard Nixon, who's trying for another merit badge from the Republican Party, got one from the New York Boy Scouts tonight. Mr. Nixon received the Good Scout Award for 1968 at the Scouts Financial Dinnerama. From our newsroom in New York, that's the news. I'm Milt Haynes. Now let's continue with Newsfront.
Thank you, Milt. Tonight may be the coldest night of the season, but today in New York there was much discussion about the long, hot nights to come this summer. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which last evening honored the Reverend James E. Groppy for his open housing fight in Milwaukee, today laid out its plans for 1968. Here to report on that meeting is Charles Evers, the NAACP's field director in Mississippi. Mr. Evers, who himself received a citation for courage last night for his efforts in registering voters in Mississippi, is the brother of the late Medgar Evers, who was killed by a sniper in 1963. Mr. Evers, how would you characterize the meeting today? Was it a meeting, as we heard in the news, of moderation, devoid of the expected militancy?
Well, actually, I think they really have our organization confused. We practically charted the same course now that we've charted for the last 50-odd years. And I remember one time we were the most militant, the most destructive group that there was. And now they're saying that some even call us Uncle Toms. But I don't think I'm in a position to say one way or the other how the meeting was today, other than it was, a very constructive meeting. We laid out our plans for our national director laid out our plans for the new year, and we plan to go back home and follow them as we have in the past. Whether we are too moderate or too militant, I think it depends on the power structure in our neighborhoods and our communities, on how far they're willing to go and what they're willing to do to eliminate either name calling.
Well, let's take Mississippi, which is, for those of us watching in the Eastern Seaboard, is an experience that's difficult to reconstruct according to our local experience. There, what tactics have you found most successful in making a start?
Well, actually, we've used so many. I think the most one that we've gotten most benefit from has been our voter registration drive and also our boycotts of white merchants who would not give our people equal jobs, who would not give them courtesy and respect, and who would not employ them in certain positions that was previously been lily white. But our greatest reward came, we feel, in the primaries and in the general election. We were able to elect 25 Negroes, actually 24 Negroes, we had one already we elected last year, to public office, where 2 years ago we had less than 28,000 Negroes registered. Now we have near 200,000 registered. And where 2 years ago we had no Negroes elected, and now we have 25 Negroes elected.
Yeah, it's most interesting to watch Mississippi because you had the largest gain of any state in the South in Negro registrations.
Well, I think we were farther behind in that
yes,
state.
Yes, well, even so, now you have more registered than any other Southern state in the Deep South.
More elected.
More elected and more registered, is that not so?
I don't know whether we have. I think Alabama has more registered, but you see, we have found that the people who have kept us down and the people who've caused us most trouble have been elected officials. And we also found that the three things that have been against us is what white Mississippians have controlled was the ballot, the dollar, and education. And we're now going after all three of them.
Well, how does this differ, in your view, basically, from the situation in the North? Is this very different as you see it?
Well, actually, I know very little about the North. I was born and reared in Mississippi, and I never like to come north, start trying to characterize or try to speak for the North. I can only speak for what we do in Mississippi and what we're going to do in Mississippi and what we're going to accept and what we're not going to accept. And I can assure you that we're not going to accept the old way anymore. And I can assure you that we're going to have Negroes elected to every position as possible in Mississippi. And once we get elected, we're going to administer justice fairly and squarely. We're not going to do the white people they've done to us, because if we just make them do right, it'll be enough.
Well, in the electoral process in Mississippi, you have a whole range of local offices you're referring to. What about statewide offices, and what about the eventual hope of taking congressional seats?
Well, actually, you know, we sort of the old school, and my mother and father had very little education, but they always told me, son, build a good, solid foundation, then put the rafters up. So that's what we're trying to do now. We're going to get those old constables, those old justice of the peaces who have mistreated us, those sheriffs, those mayors, and those county supervisors who have kept industry out because they didn't want to get a decent job. And then we're going to, after we get that really built, then we're going to go after the legislature. But we're going to jump this time for Congress, because, you know, we now have elect John Bear William, who was our congressman from the 3rd Congressional District. And we are now getting ready to we're going to run a Negro this time, which as soon as the governor sets the election date, we're certainly going to run a Negro, try to take Mr. Williams' place. Now, whether we win, lose, or draw, we're just going to make sure from now on that the racists and the bigots in Mississippi will not have a field's day in going to office. They're going to fight for it. It's going to cost them something.
The Negro now is not afraid to come out and register and vote in Mississippi?
Well, there are still a few. I'm not going to lie and say that we all are brave, but most of us have realized that why be afraid? Because they're going to kill us, or they're going to beat us, or they're going to do these things anyway. So maybe we'll go out and try to get some Negro registered and get some decent white people elected, and then we can change that. Being afraid is not going to stop the beating and the killing and the bombings. And the only way to stop it is to eliminate those who are responsible. And our law enforcement officers and our elected officials have been the ones who've been totally responsible for the mistreatment of Negroes, and not only Negroes, the whites who would want to do what's right. They're afraid. And we're going to have to free the poor, scared whites there, as well as the Negroes.
How does the NAACP stand in relation to other civil rights organizations in Mississippi? You have more militant organizations that are pushing and asking for more dramatic action than the NAACP in Mississippi?
Well, actually, we don't. I don't have time to worry about other organizations. I think we all are doing what we can, and I just try to do my little bit. And whatever they're doing, we're glad they are, because it takes all of us, and it needs all of us. And we're going to continue to fight to make it better for the militant, the non-militant, whatever you want to call it, classify us. We feel we're just trying to make America realize that this is all of our country and that we're going to enjoy it.
What kind of reaction do the people in, your people in Mississippi have to the big news that the riots made in northern cities last summer and all of what was called the white backlash? Does this worry you and the people in Mississippi, the Negroes in Mississippi?
Well, the only thing that worries us is when is white America going to realize that the cause of these things is because they've deprived the Negro of the basic thing which America stands for. You know, I don't really think that the riots have been as severe as people have pretended. I don't know, I don't live up here. But if white America, in particular those in the North, would just do the basic things that they should do, we could eliminate this. If they would allow Negroes to participate in the local government, if they allow Negroes to be appointed to boards and give them a decent job and open housing and better schools and rid this de facto segregation and all these type of things and give us a chance to be a good American, then you could eliminate this.
Yes, but this doesn't worry your people in terms of a backlash in Mississippi.
Well, that's never, you know, that's an excuse. The word backlash is an excuse for racism. They've always had that feeling, and this is an excuse they use, that we're going to get back at the niggas because they are getting too smart. Well, see, white America has not yet, from New York to California, have not yet been able to accept what they call the sassy Negro. And that's the Negro who stand up and tell him what's right and stand up for what he believes in and stand up for what's right for all of us. And so this is a reaction of what they've always had. It's just a real color coming out.
We heard earlier that Adam Clayton Powell returned to the country and went to California a little earlier tonight, although he's not coming back to New York until he said his lawyers say he can. Well, what's your comment on Representative Powell and that whole issue?
Well, my only comment is that I feel that Representative have been used, and he was made an example of because he was a Negro, because there are senators and representatives in Congress who have done much worse than Congressman Powell ever did. And they were not made an example out of. There are congressmen who have not only have they made illegal trips, but they have their whole family on the payroll. I know in Mississippi, in the postal office department, the postmasters, the husband, the postmaster, the wife is the postmistress, and the son is the mail carrier. So you see, it's not such thing as stacking the books with family, because if so, they should clean the house all the way down. I feel that Mr. Powell, if it was me, I'd come back in New York and face and whatever it is I have coming.
You think he should do this?
I think he should do it. I think he should come on back here and stand up, because you can't defeat him by running from him.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Evers, for this report tonight on today's meeting and the situation in Mississippi.
Thank you.
And now, Newsfront commentary. Quincy Howe on Europe's new impression of the dollar and the new American balance of payment policies.
Come back next year for the devaluation announcement. According to the Wall Street Journal, that was what one Washington insider said last week after President Johnson revealed his plans to strengthen the dollar and stem the gold flow. Well, not many Americans take quite so dim a view of the president's program. Most Europeans take a dimmer view. The Financial Times of London, Britain's equivalent of the Wall Street Journal, declared last week that unless gold starts flowing back to the United States on an appreciable scale, the gold drain will continue and perhaps accelerate. The Financial Times also estimates that the present gold reserves of the United States at about $11 billion. In other words, about $1 billion less than the Johnson administration assumes. Now, according to the London Economist, Britain's most widely quoted and respected weekly, if the Johnson curbs on trade, travel, and investments come anywhere near close to achieving their stated target, they could do more to undermine than bolster the present gold exchange standard. Now, here's what the Economist said. The stated object of the cuts is to improve America's balance of payments by $3 billion in the year ahead. If America achieves this, it would mean under present world conditions that all other countries' balances of payments taken together would have to deteriorate by $3 billion a year, and the strains this would create around the world would be immense. Then there's Professor Raymond Aron, who teaches political science at the University of Paris and writes two columns a week for the conservative Paris Figaro. He offers this appraisal. Now that the United States has become the international banker of the free world, its investments in Middle Eastern oil fields and British and German automobile factories far surpass its debts. But no banker can turn his long-term assets into hard cash overnight. If the foreigners start turning all the dollars they hold into gold, they can drain off the entire gold supply of the United States and still hold some $15 billion for which there just wouldn't be any gold backing at all. Now, before this happens, according to Professor Aron, the United States would either stop changing any dollars into gold or else demand $70 or more for every ounce of gold. Professor Aron predicts that the United States will have to do one or the other of these two things, and maybe both. But, he adds, it will not hurt France more than it will hurt the United States. Few Americans agree with Professor Aron that the American dollar will find itself in any such squeeze during the current year. Few Frenchmen agree with Professor Aron that they will be the ones to suffer if things do come to such a pass. But it all goes back to the Vietnam War, into which the United States is now pouring $25 billion a year. These $25 billion have not only thrown the federal budget way out of balance, they also account for the bulk of the balance of payments deficit. 2 years ago, the Johnson administration rejected the advice of those who urged a tax boost to absorb some of the mounting deficits in the federal budget and in the balance of payments. Because the president refused to call for a tax increase, refused to de-escalate the Vietnam War, he must now fish or cut bait. To fish is to double or treble the price of gold. To cut bait is to base the dollar on some other standard than gold. Quincy Howe reporting.
Now Newsfront picks up the thread on one of the big stories of last Friday. The federal indictment of five citizens for counseling Selective Service registrants to resist the draft and surrender their cards, and for attempting to interrupt the induction process at draft centers across the country. The most prominent figure in the group is the 64-year-old New Haven-born pediatrician, Dr. Benjamin Spock. Dr. Spock, who served as a lieutenant commander in the Naval Reserve in World War II and who supported President Johnson in 1964, began his active protest against Vietnam policy as a part of the SANE anti-war program in 1965. Dr. Spock, since we talked on Friday and since the indictment, what's happened over the weekend on this case? Have you finally received the indictment, per se?
I finally did in the mail this morning and brought it down, showed it to my lawyer. He wanted to see it. I was going to give it to my secretary for a souvenir, but the lawyer said he had to see it.
Well, what did he say? This indictment certainly is a legal document that carries the potential of a prison term.
That's right. I think one thing that I found out this morning that surprised me in talking to him is that there'll be all kinds of maneuverings, motions from our side. I'm not going to be brought to the court in Boston until the 29th of this month. Then he says there'll be a month or two of postponement while the lawyers study the case. Then he says our side will be making motions, which most of which will be turned down. Then he says we'll really get to the trial about October. Well, I was all ready to go to trial and even maybe go to jail, so I realized it's all a long way off compared to my picture.
Yes, well, this October date is interesting insofar
this
as
is this
would
guessing,
precede the election in November.
Yes.
And would your plan be, if possible, to bring this to trial or to a head prior to the November election?
Well, he implied that the legal process is going to take until October before we have a real trial, that there will be objections that our side has to take and that each of those takes time to answer.
But you don't have any position as to whether you would want this to be tried before the election in November or after?
No, I expect to go on working politically and in demonstrations both, but I gather that this has nothing to do with our choice. This is the legal process.
What do you think the effect of a trial on the election feelings in the country would be, this public debate of the issue that would be surrounding a trial of you and the others on trial?
I imagine it'll help to sharpen people's feelings on both sides. I think I have the feeling already that the indictment of these five people, and I understand there's at least eight more to come, that this has stirred up a lot of indignation, of course, in the peace people. I have no doubt it stirred up the indignation of the war people, too, who think we're traitors, and the sooner we're put away, the better.
Well, between this time and the time that the trial will come up, what do you think this will do to those who were thinking of going as far as you have gone and now see the indictment and the possibility of a serious legal involvement a reality?
Oh, I think my guess would be strongly that it'll encourage people who have thought of resisting the draft to go ahead and do it, because I think that when you're considering something that may land you in jail and that certainly is going to make you be looked down on by some members of your family and your friends, you want company in this. And so my feeling would be very strongly that this will encourage those who have been thinking of resistance.
You don't think this has a dampening effect because of the fact now that the government has stepped in, that they have taken action, that apparently at one time it was thought they might simply sit back and avoid acting.
Pretend not to see.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I may be viewing it entirely mistakenly, but my suspicion would be strongly that this would encourage people to resist who've been thinking of resisting.
What kind of response have you gotten over the weekend from your acquaintances and from those that have known what you've done and from strangers in regard to this
case?
Well,
of course, the people that we've mostly heard of is friends and strangers who think that it's the right thing, who feel that one must oppose the war in every way possible. The mail that came this morning, and of course this is the first chance for there to be mail since I was indicted, The mail was, and the telegrams are very predominantly from people who are very favorable to it, but I got a few nasty letters this morning.
Yes, any copies of your book returned again as you had in the past?
No, not this time.
Not this time, no. Be a lot to come back if they did. The New York Times this morning editorialized on this subject, and I'd like to quote one phrase. They said that it may be asked why these opponents of the draft and the war, which it helps to sustain, are not content to work within the normal machinery of a democratic society. This is not Hitler's Germany, where citizens had no recourse to political action to exchange, to change public policies. Americans enjoy and exercise guaranteed rights of peaceful protest and participation in governmental policies. What's your answer to that statement?
Well, I think that I and most people in the peace movement have been working in every conceivable way. I've sent thousands of letters to the president and to the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State and to my senators when I lived in Ohio and New York. I participated actively in politics in the 66 campaign and expect to be increasingly busy in the 68 political campaign. And I've marched and I've demonstrated. None of them, of course, have apparently made a dent on the administration. I think, to put it more sharply, I'm not content just to wait until the election, because I'm not sure there is going to be a United States in the fall of 1968. I think that the president doesn't know anything to do except to keep escalating, and sooner or later he's going to escalate us into war with China, and we may at the same time get involved in war with the Soviet Union. So that my feeling is that we've got to press the most dramatic kind of objection to the war, and my own feeling is that the young men who are resisting the draft, and we're, after all, only supporting and encouraging them, that the young men who are resisting the draft probably are the cutting edge at the present time of the peace movement, that if the 1,000 who've already turned in their cards encourage 10,000, if they encourage 100,000, this might really stop the government or slow it down.
Well, now, you talk about making a dent. We just have a moment to pursue this point, but those who criticize your stance and the stance of others who have taken this course say that you leave no room for compromise, that you propose such a drastic reversal of policy that the normal political processes are aborted. And what do you mean by making a dent? What would satisfy you and those who support your position?
As a matter of fact, the administration would have to go a lot further than it's gone so far, because they not only will have to agree to nominally negotiate, I think that they've got to show a willingness eventually to get out of Vietnam and let the Vietnamese people decide things for themselves. I think it came out very clearly in the interview with William Bundy this morning that our government is still determined to win and to keep permanent control of South Vietnam. You know, Bundy said this morning, there is no sign yet they're ready to yield. This is what our government is waiting for, and I don't think that the Vietnamese are ever going to yield.
Well, in order for you to reverse your own position, to say, well, we have made our point, what would the government have to do at this point?
They'd first have to signal by being willing to stop the bombing without any condition, any promise from the other side, and I think that they also have got to say that they're willing eventually to get out, for the United States to get out of Vietnam.
Newsfront is coming to you through the facilities of the Eastern Educational Network. Now, Newsfront Part 2, including the Arab view of Israeli Premier Eshkol's U.S. visit and Barbara Junker's update report on the implications of heart transplant surgery. But first, the arts. The author of a new book that has caused widespread reaction, Norman Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine, whose newest book is called Making It. Mr. Podhoretz is interviewed by Jonathan Eisen of Commonweal Magazine.
Good evening. Tonight's guest, Norman Podhoretz, editor of Commentary, is author of Making It, a book just brought out by Random House. Making It chronicles the rise of the author from the Brooklyn slums to the citadels of the New York literary establishment, charting his rising star to his present job as editor of Commentary. The point you stress, Mr. Podhoretz, over again and over again is that the desire to succeed has become at least the intellectual establishment's dirty little secret. one that people are now at pains to suppress with as great a vigor as the lust that D.H. Lawrence uncovered was suppressed earlier in the century. Do you really see The Dirty Little Secret as terribly important outside of the specific group of literary intellectuals that you describe in your book?
Oh, yes. I think that it's, if you read a book about America, almost any book, you'll be told that all Americans care only about success as measured in material terms, terms of money. My own observation is that most of us are more deeply ambivalent about success than that. That is to say, I think it's impossible, virtually impossible, to grow up in this country without, on the one hand, thinking that the goal of life is indeed to be a success, and without, on the other hand, being made to feel through certain other aspects of our culture that the desire for success is a corrupting force in one's life, and that that personal salvation, and I mean this in secular terms, depends on transcending this desire and ultimately being indifferent to it. And certainly if you don't succeed in transcending it, you're supposed to pretend that you have. It's extremely bad manners to call attention to this desire or to its achievement if you're lucky enough to have realized it.
Your book has gotten thus far mixed reviews.
Yeah.
One reviewer even going so far as to call you a fame and success lecher. But throughout the book...
That confirms the point, by the way. The word lecher, I mean.
Throughout the book, you evince a rather ambivalent attitude toward success itself, and at the very beginning, in fact, that it appalls me to think of what an immense transformation I had to work on my myself in order to become what I have become. Presumably, you're describing the price a person has to pay in this society for success.
Yeah, well, in this case, the particular price I had in mind was describing had to do with the issue of class, about which I think most Americans are extremely disingenuous. We like to think that class is not a factor in this society. I think it's an extremely important factor, which has been much overlooked and ignored. And I was talking about the movement from one social class to another social class, and the kind of thing that happens to any individual who has to undergo this movement.
In your autobiography, you mentioned that
I prefer to call it an auto-confessional case history. It's not strictly
speaking. In your confessional case history, strictly speaking, you mentioned that the movement that you just described has placed you eventually in America's upper middle class, where you are identified not so much by income, I believe you're right, but by style of speech, education, dress, and the like. And then you go on to say that you're perfectly happy here.
No, I don't say I'm happy. I say I'm acculturated, at ease. I'm sometimes happy and sometimes not in the situation in which I find myself. But I say I live in it with ease, yeah.
At one point, toward the end of the book, in describing what success looked like, you write that it really looks like stretching one's arms out idly by the side of a swimming pool. And having two white-coated servants vie for the privilege of depositing a Bloody Mary into one's hand. Now, how do these terms of success differ for you as a literary man from, say, a business establishment or even our less venerated establishments in the political or business
sphere? Oh, well, I'm talking about worldly success, which I think is the same for anyone and is measured by the same things, namely money, power, fame, social position. I'm not talking about success in the intrinsic sense, that is, as measured by the distinction or quality of one's achievements as a literary person. And indeed, I think that the use of the word success as applied, say, to a great poet, as a poet, not, say, as a rich man, is an attempt to claim worldly measurements for something that ought not to be measured by those standards. No, obviously worldly success has to do with what everyone knows it has to do. In that sense, it's the same for Robert Lowell as for the president of General Motors, though obviously their intrinsic achievements have to be measured by a different standard.
Yet, And may I pick you up on this? You do suggest on page 346 that society is coming more and more to reward literary or intrinsic qualities in the sense that it once rewarded business acumen.
Right. I don't think there's any question about that. That is, it is now possible to acquire a greater measure of worldly success.
Do you see any danger for? Do you see any danger for the literary vocation in ascribing to it the same motives or rewards that have been ascribed to other endeavors?
No, because you know the aphorism "power corrupts" is always quoted. I myself tend to believe that the absence of power corrupts even more, and I don't think that this particular phase of American culture, that is, the phase in which people of intrinsic cultural achievement are being rewarded more than they used to be, I don't think that this will necessarily either help or hinder intrinsic achievement, though it certainly makes life better for the people involved in the arts.
Yet,
there's no particular virtue in starving in a garret, it seems to me.
That's perfectly true, but isn't there a danger for the literary vocation to accept the rewards of the society so completely, or at least as completely as you seem to accept it in making it, where you write that this is the world in which I now live with such perfect ease?
Well, I don't think I accept it. I don't think that's what that phrase means. No, I'm simply saying that one needn't feel guilty about worldly goods, that I think there's been a certain corruption of our attitudes toward these things, which is explained by a very long history of the relation between the artist and so-called bourgeois society. I also think, as I said before, that there is no necessary relation between success in the worldly sense and virtue, or failure in the worldly sense and virtue.
But how do you see the critical vocation as evolving with this outlook?
You mean are people preempted or co-opted by the society?
I'm asking you if the desire for success doesn't take the edge off criticism in a world where people are at pains to live in it at perfect ease.
Well, in my experience, the people in the critical vocation who've achieved the most worldly success have been those who've been the most critical, not those who've been the least critical. This is one of the peculiarities of our time. The mass audience is very ready to award people who want to attack it, and the more fiercely they attack it, the more heavily they're rewarded. I don't say this is a good thing, but I believe it to be a fact.
And a continuing irony in American society, and with
didn't
that,
used to be the case in American society,
but apparently it is,
it
now,
is now.
And thank you very much for being with us
thank
tonight.
You.
The human heart. 4 human transplant attempts, 2 still survive. The drama of human organ surgery captures the imagination and sends the mind off in many new directions. As the surgeon breaks new ground, the patient, the donor, and society must rethink old ideas. For a look at some of the implications of these dramatic developments in heart surgery, let's turn now to New York Post medical writer and columnist Barbara Yunker.
What you just saw was a heart that was beating. That's a very dramatic sight. Not many people have seen it in person. Yet in a single month, the idea of taking one heart from one human being and putting it into another has become almost commonplace to us because it's been in our headlines day after day for the last 5 weeks. This miraculous new advance in science has opened up many, many questions. They're moral, social, ethical, practical. One of the first that people have been asking science writers and doctors is, why is it if they don't live after such an operation, they don't die because the heart fails? Well, the reason for that is that a very healthy heart, even though it was in a person who died, has been put into somebody who is desperately, desperately ill. And so Louis Wyshonsky, the man who was the first patient to receive a human heart, died of an infection. This is going to be a problem that doctors will face for a very long time, because if they make the human body whole still for the new heart, they have to open the body up to the danger of infection. Mike Kasparik, the first American adult to receive another heart and try to live with it, had another crisis today. He had critical internal bleeding, which the latest news reports indicate may have been brought under control. Again, this is because he was desperately sick, and that leads us to one of the really difficult ethical questions, and that is, how do you decide who is to receive a human heart? As Dr. Shumway said before he did his first operation, when he was discussing the possibilities of it, it really takes a lot of courage for a man to decide to take out a heart, which, however sick it is, has at least kept that man alive up until this point. It's a big decision to make. There are many physicians who say that it can't be done. For example, for a man who just has a coronary heart attack, although that's the big American killer, it kills more than any other disease, it's a very unpredictable disease and sometimes they recover. And so it's got to be, for a surgeon to dare to lift out a human heart, it's got to be somebody who he knows cannot survive his illness. And then, how do you choose a donor? Well, the donor has to be somebody who has just died. Also has to be somebody who fits. It takes an awful big coincidence now to get a recipient and a donor together. But even if you have a recipient and a donor together, then you have another tremendous moral decision, which the doctors are wrestling with now as these transplants come into not common practice, but into understood medical procedure. When is death? We used to think it was when the heart stops, but now we know that it's not necessarily when the heart stops, because we can restart stopped hearts. If you're a surgeon who has a patient who might be saved with a human heart, and the possibility is there, who protects the donor's interest? You've got somebody from an accident who is in terrible, terrible trouble. Who is the person seeing to it that the person who is giving the organ has every chance to be saved? Somebody's got to see to it that the donor never stops being a patient. As Dr. Shumway again, the surgeon, Dr. Norman E. Shumway of Stanford, the surgeon who has done the first American adult transplant, says, we're going to have to talk about reversible death and irreversible death, and these are very, very hard decisions which we have to make. Perhaps the solution will come gradually, and the doctors are looking forward to this day when the immunology problems will be solved and the donor will be a volunteer. Perhaps we will have tattooed on our wrists, those of us who want this to happen, that we will be available if we die in such a way that this is possible, that the heart or the kidney or the spare part that might mean life to another human being, that we decide to give it. Until then, until that day, and until the doctors learn how to take spare parts and keep them, these are questions which the doctors are not going to be able to answer alone. Certainly the lawyers can't answer them. These are problems which all of society is going to have to look to and help solve. Good night. This is Barbara Yunker.
Now, Newsfront issue. The Mideast debate revives amid the American visit of Israeli Premier Levi Eshkol, returning to New York tonight from a weekend visit with President Johnson in Texas. What is the American-Arab reaction? Has anything changed since the June war? We talk now with Mohammed T. Mehdi, director of the Action Committee for American-Arab Relations and author of a book called Peace in the Middle East. Mr. Mehdi acts as a spokesman for Arab opinion in the United States and last week called for a ban on the sale of Israeli bonds in the U.S. to, as he put it, help stem the drain of U.S. dollars abroad. Mr. Mehdi, you've made some statements indicating that you oppose the visit of Israeli Premier Eshkol to the United States. Why do you oppose that visit?
It is not that we oppose his visit. We oppose his attempt.
You've made statements which indicate that, from what I gather, you oppose the visit of the Israeli Premier Levi Eshkol to the United States. Why is that?
We are not opposed to his visit. What we are opposed is his endeavors to seek American arms to strengthen Israeli military capacity further. And as a matter of fact, we have requested President Johnson to receive Mr. Eshkol courteously, but firmly refuse his demands for arms.
Now, you say we. Who do you mean by we?
Yes, I am referring to the Action Committee on American-Arab Relations, which at present and on this particular issue represents more than 1 million American Arabs.
There are 1 million Americans of Arab descent in this country.
That is correct.
Who finances the operation?
The members of the Action Committee and the American Arabs and other friends of the American Arab cause.
This you don't receive any funds from any of the Arab governments abroad?
No, this is a private American organization, just as, say, the American Jewish Congress or the American Jewish Committee are American organizations. Similarly, the Action Committee is an American organization.
Are you an American citizen, Mr. Mehdi?
In the process.
In the process?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been in the process?
Well, the process sometimes takes longer than one would like to, but it is within the legal system.
Yes. I understand you've had some difficulties with the immigration people.
Yes, that is correct. I have had some difficulties because I have been speaking loud opposed to Zionism, and the Zionists have had a great deal of pressures upon the immigration office, attempting to actually, in violation of the laws of the United States, to ask me to depart from these United States.
Isn't the implication, Mr. Mehdi, that you have actually been speaking as a representative of a foreign government and have been violating the Justice Department ban on such activity for aliens?
Not at all. The First Amendment to the Constitution, which I hope you will reread it, and the various decisions of the Supreme Court, which guarantee freedom of speech of the human person, citizen or otherwise, says that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. We have brought charges against Mr. Esperdy that he has attempted deliberately to suppress freedom of speech in this country, opposing Arabs.
Who's Mr. Esperdy?
Mr. Esperdy is the director of the immigration of New York district. And I think he has been under the pressure of the unscrupulous Zionists who want to limit the freedom of speech of the American Arabs. And of course, they will not be able to succeed.
Yes. Well, let's get back, if we can, and leave that for a moment to the request for military aid that you indicate that the Premier Eshkol will make of President Johnson during his visit here. If he does, is it not true that King Hussein of Jordan and other Arab leaders have made similar requests for military assistance?
As a matter of fact, no. King Hussein came here and he did not request aid. What he wanted was political American support. In my opinion, American military aid to Israel will be detrimental on the long run to the American interest, to the Israeli interest itself also. It will further push the Arab world towards the Soviet Union. The Arabs will become more and more dependent on the Soviets. The end result may be that someday, while towards the Far East, we are so pleased that Formosa is with us, only the mainland China is gone. In the Middle East, we'll say that Israel is with us, only the entire Arab world has gone by default to the communists.
But isn't it correct, to the reports that we've been reading, that the State Department has been recommending and that the President has been considering providing arms to both sides in the Middle East?
The State Department has been ill at ease at the whole problem. And of course, the State Department is an agency of the White House. And the White House is an agency of the American political community. And the President is, of course, susceptible to an election year. The Republicans have been demanding that Israel should receive more arms, and of course the chief politician, Johnson, would not want to lose the Jewish vote. As a matter of fact, I think President Johnson really doesn't dislike the Arabs any more than he would like Jews. But he loves the White House, naturally, and in order to get the Jewish vote, so-called.
So you claim this is all a political move on his part?
Oh, absolutely. There is no doubt. And the moment that he will recognize that the American Arab vote and the vote of the millions of the American people here would not support any further American support to Israel, Johnson will change his position.
But isn't it true, Mr. Mehdi, that during the June war and subsequently, the overwhelming percentage of Americans, according to all of the public opinion polls, were behind the Israeli position?
I am not quite sure of this fact, but even if that were the case, it really does not mean any more than the totality of mass media of communication influenced the general public opinion. but on the long run, and any reasonable analysis would indicate that American interest is naturally with the 100 million Arabs and not with Israel. To support Israel further, it would really aggravate the situation.
Well, now, do you feel that the Arabs that you claim to represent in this country would support what I assume is your position, that there should be a total embargo on the shipment of any arms to the Middle East?
That is correct. Our position is that we are opposed to the sending of American arms to the whole Middle East. We are opposed to sending American arms to Israel as well as to the Arab states.
What about other arms in the Middle East? How do you feel about the arms that the United Arab Republic has been buying from the Soviet Union? Apparently the Soviet Union has completely re-equipped the armies of the United Arab Republic.
We are also opposed to the Soviet Union sending arms to the area. But let us remember that assuming that the Soviet Union has indeed re-equipped the United Arab Republic, and the United Arab Republic today is on the level of June 4th last, at best, this means that it will take 6 days of Israeli military operation. So the Arabs have to become 50 times as strong as they were on June 4th to be able to match Israeli military power.
Well, isn't this indeed what you are proposing in your so-called peace plan for the Middle East, that peace be maintained until the Arab countries are strong enough to be in a position not to be defeated by Israel?
Well, what we are really proposing is more than this and more important. We are suggesting that opportunities should be provided for those Jews who have gone from Europe to Palestine, and now they may wish to leave Israel to depart. In our judgment, according to our studies, there has been already over 100,000 former Israeli Jews who live in New York City alone. These have come here under trying circumstances. If opportunities are given to them, large segments of them, as human individuals, would leave. Naturally, their leaders will not be happy about this.
Yes, but from what I gather, this particular point that you make has been challenged not by Israelis alone, but by others, reporters and the like, who have been in Israel, that there are no large number of Israelis who want to leave Israel at this time.
Well, I suggest let us try it. I think the Israelis have so far had some $3 billion helping Jews to go there. If we have $20 million for 1 year to be offered to those Jews who want to get out of Israel,
well, now, what is the objective of this? To reduce the Jewish population of Palestine, the area you refer to as Palestine, and to eliminate Israel as a political state?
Well, I think the whole concept of a Jewish state is a repugnant concept to any self-respecting, egalitarian, civil libertarian 20th century man. A Jewish state, a Christian state, a Muslim state are obnoxious to one's taste. They're as obnoxious as either a racial concept or a religious concept.
But Israel now has in its population almost as many Arabs as Jews.
But the whole idea of a Jewish state, assume that we call America as a Christian state. And
I don't
there are
think
some
the Israelis
Jews in
refer
America.
To it as a Jewish state, do they, Mr. Mehdi? They of refer course. To it not as a theocracy, but as a democracy.
Well, it is a Jewish state, the whole idea. Let's call that America is a Christian state, but not a theocracy. Nevertheless, it would be obnoxious to your taste. Or if by America, let's call it a Caucasian state, and so there are also some Negroes in it. Or as a Christian state, we say that in America, there are some Jews in American Congress. This will not appeal to your taste, Mr.
But the objective of what you state, Mr. Mehdi, is that Israel should cease to exist as a state.
What I'm suggesting is that there will be no peace in the area as long as Mr. Eshkol, and he is from Russia, wants to be in
Romania, I understand.
No, he's Russia. It was mentioned in the New York Times 2 days ago that he was from Romania. Mr. Abba Iban is an Englishman. He's as much of an Englishman as
Well,
Senator
you're not an
Jacobs.
American. You come from where, Mr. Mehdi?
When I came here, I came and I'm coming with the permission of the American people.
Yes.
But when Mr. Iban, an Englishman, goes there, he went there against the will of the Arab people. And I suggest that Iban is as much of an Englishman as Jacob Javits is an American.
But you're saying that only those who were born in Egypt and whose families were born in Egypt should live in Egypt, and those who were born in Jordan and should live in Jordan?
No, I believe in travel, but today we are not in a stage on the international scene that anyone can travel to go any place. They have to go under certain specific circumstances. And when Mr. Iban of England went to Palestine, he violated the rights of the Arab people of Palestine. And our position is that the Zionist Jews, Iban of England, Michel Comeau, South Africa, and the rest, have indeed committed a genocide against the Arab people of Palestine by erecting a Jewish state there. Now, a genocide does not necessarily mean to have to kill people. Genocide is a systematic destruction of a people, and this is precisely what the Zionists have done to the country of Palestine and to the people of Palestine. You
Mr.
do not
McNeil,
have...
Let me ask you finally, because we're running out of time. You don't for one moment believe, however, that this plan of yours is practical or could conceivably be put into effect. You don't believe for a moment that there would be no Israel as a recognized state.
Oh, I believe in it, and I think the American Jews, humanitarian as they are, sensitive as they will recognize sooner or later that they have committed an injustice against the Arab people, and that the only way for peace is for the gradual return of the Jews to their countries of origin or their immigration to North America, with letting the people of Palestine to go back to their countries.
Thank you, Ms. Mechti, for your peace plan for the Middle East.
Thank you indeed.
Now, before our preview of tomorrow, here with some late news and weather is Milt Haynes.
According to the city's investigations commissioner, all is still not well in the city's water department. You'll remember it was less than a month ago that the James Marcus scandal in that department had the City Hall politicians trembling. Today, another pair of indictments caused an uproar. A chief clerk and inspector charged with accepting $7,000 in bribe money for rigging the bills of a chemical company. Authorities are refusing to say whether the Marcus and this latest case are related, but they did say they're looking into reports that there have been other payoffs to city officials. The City Council's hearings on that proposed taxi fare boost got started today. We'll be hearing more about that as time goes along. The weather forecast for the metropolitan area, still great for Eskimos. Clear, very cold conditions predicted for tonight. The temperatures in the city down to zero. They're just about there now. In the outlying suburbs, 5 to 10 degrees below zero temperatures are expected. And tomorrow, things will get increasingly cloudy as the day wears on, with a chance of more snow by nightfall. The temperatures, however, should be a bit warmer, high somewhere in the 20s. Right now, Mitchell, it's 2 degrees above zero in Manhattan.
Thank you, Milt, and that's News Front for tonight. Tomorrow at 10, Harrison Salisbury, assistant managing editor of the New York Times, who just 1 year ago this week returned from his historic visit to North Vietnam, assesses the current reports of new peace initiatives from Hanoi, fact or fantasy. And following today's meeting in Warsaw between the American and Chinese Communist ambassadors, Swedish journalist Harald Duntekaus, just back from the Chinese mainland, provides his update report on the Cultural Revolution. So until then at 10, I'm Mitchell Krause. Good night for News Front.